Good evening. It is a real pleasure to be here in this breathing room, this beautiful breathing room. The roots of the world, opening up the ground of our practice. My friend and neighbor for many years was Zen priest Yvonne Rand. And I loved living next door to Yvonne. It was a great joy. I remember in the morning, she'd be outside calling one of her numerous dogs. And my favorite call was hearing her say, "Shadow, here, Shadow, Shadow, Shadow." So it's so great when a Zen teacher with some real gravitas calls her Shadow in full voice, begins the day by calling her Shadow. One of the wonderful qualities of a breathing room like this one and the sangha that you convene and then let be free in the wider community is calling and welcoming the shadow, the dark, the unnamed, the unformed, the mystery. And, you know, Yvonne used to remind me that whenever we have the opportunity to gather together and be in Sangha, it's wonderful to set the intention for our time together. So I am aware tonight of the many beings for whom working and celebrating the garden is not physically so possible. I'm thinking in particular of our beloved friend and community member Grace Damman from Green Gulch Farm Zen Center, who a week ago, when driving home from San Francisco with her 14-year-old daughter, and their dog, Mac, her car was hit head-on, and a terrible accident. Grace took the blow. Sabrina, her daughter's hand, was broken, and the dog was jostled up a bit, but it took paramedics about an hour to get Grace out of the car. The bridge was closed for more than an hour and a half. And one of our wonderful practitioners, whom His Holiness honored a few years ago as an unsung hero of compassion, was airlifted to the Muir Center, not far from here. And she's there tonight. And I was very, very happy to be sitting here with you, closer to Grace, in every way. And I'm just recognizing how many beings in our wide circle may be in this delicate place between worlds. And so tremendous love and dedication to those many beings. Let's just take a moment. And in our maybe three deep breaths, let whoever you would like to have be included in our circle tonight come forward in just sitting and gathering the breath. And this is not grim business. It's the work of summoning the beloved and the unknown, the known and the unknown, to increase our circle, to widen the context. So very much the intention for this evening is to widen the context of what a garden is, what a sangha is, what practice is, and to do it in a very grounded way with each of you. Tonight, I was so happy to have a phone call from James asking me to come and practice, be here with you, and to read from the book. And I called him and said, "Is there some theme you'd like me to work with?" And he said, "Oh, just bring up the garden." So I thought, okay. So I'd like to do that tonight and draw on the this book that took me 13 years to write, Gardening at the Dragon's Gate. My husband calls it Dragging at the Garden Gate. He's all too accurate. It's all too accurate. He knows of which he speaks, of what he speaks. But, you know, to really convey our practice and the liveliness and mystery and dedication and humor and exhaustion with our practice, it takes as long as it takes. So for me, 13 years is a fitting amount of time. And it was always clear from the very beginning of this, and I was invited to write this book, believe it or not, asked to record or to reflect on my experience, the pleasure of being invited to work in the garden. It is never the gardener that makes a garden, said my teacher, Alan Chadwick. It's always the other way around. The garden makes the gardener. That's the way it really works. So I'm always amused when people say I'm the founder of the garden. I think I'm the servant of the garden. I'm the slave of the garden. and the student, the great and active and living and immensely grateful student of the natural world, and learning every day, fresh, fresh, fresh. Every day a fresh surprise. And in that world of surprise, there is, maybe tonight there's enough, I feel in this room, both a lightness, a rising mind, and then also the rootedness or the gravitas that makes me feel at home. Knowing, just watching what you all are doing and knowing a bit about how important this Sangha has been in the lives of some of my closest friends, I know we have a stomach both for celebration and also for real grief, for the fact that we're living in such extraordinary times. And I've been thinking a lot of my home watershed, the watershed where I've lived for 35 years in Muir Beach, 25 years in residence at Green Gulch Farm, and now for the last almost 10 years living with my family off campus, one circle out. Because if the venerables don't move away, the young can't come and make a mess of the garden and you know, redo it. So we live in widening circles. And I live in Muir Beach, and I live right on the edge of Redwood Creek, which is a short 7-mile run, a small, intense river that runs from the crest of Mount Tamalpais down on the western facing flanks of the mountain, West Hill Mountain, out to the Pacific Ocean. And every winter, for as long as I can remember, and much longer than I can remember, the river has been alive with the ancient coho salmon, silver salmon of our watershed, making their way up from a large, wide gyre in the Pacific Ocean, a 3-year journey in the ocean, coming back home to their natal stream, which is the stream I live on, to spawn and die. So my life as a meditator and as a gardener has been punctuated with this passage. So I'd like to begin by just calling up these fish and how they are significant, and just remembering the more than human world that makes our lives and creates our consciousness and awareness. And in particular, calling up the salmon tonight, because this is the first year in recorded history when not a single fish came into the watershed because of the situation in the warming of the oceans, the pollution, the withholding of water, the causes and conditions. And we're not here to flail ourselves with whips or nettles, but to take in the truth of that fact and to live with it, to practice in the lively place of awareness. In the beginning of the book, I thought, well, of course the book should begin with a tribute to where I'm privileged to work and garden and live and practice. So the first chapter is called The Voice of the Watershed. Every year in the beginning of February, we organize a yearly walk and spend one entire day slowly pacing the margins of Redwood Creek watershed when we climb up the steep shinned flanks of Mount Tamalpais and reach the coastal meadows just below Druid Heights. The voices of the tributary waters of Redwood Creek burst forth. Some years on this watershed walk, we are deafened by the roar of these creeks. Then we stand together above the multiple cascades pouring off the Dipsy Trail and call at top volume their given names. Fern Creek, Kent Creek, Spike Buck Creek, we shout. Rattlesnake Creek, Green Gulch Creek. When Redwood Creek is at its height in the winter season, it is the southernmost spawning ground of the ancient silver salmon, members of the coho salmon line, a fish more primitive even than the prehistoric redwood trees that shelter their ancestral breeding grounds. Salmon can only live where the waters are cool and fresh, full of debris. Secret, unharnessed rivers are their ancestral home. As recently as the early 1900s, when salmon entered the great estuary of the San Francisco Bay to journey up the Sacramento River and spawn, they clogged the neck of the Carquinez Strait leading into the river. There were so many salmon you could cross the strait on their backs, bragged old residents of that area. And they say that when horseback riders tried to cross the river at the narrow places, they would not enter the river because of the thick presence of the fish. They would paw the river and refuse to go in. It was not so long ago. Now the salmon numbers are far less, and the short 7-mile run at Redwood Creek is one of the last unstocked winter river courses for coho silver salmon in the world. The silver salmon live at sea for 2 to 3 years before coming home to their exact natal estuary to spawn and die. Salmon navigate with the aid of an inner magnetic map and a keen sense of day length, so any given fish knows approximately where it is in relation to its home watershed at all times. As spawning season nears, the salmon develop a heightened sense of smell and may actually locate their home stream by tasting and smelling the familiar waters where they were born. Now, it makes perfect sense to me that salmon would know home by the taste of their natal streams. I'm convinced that each particular place where we garden and set down roots has its distinct scent and taste. When I come home from a long journey away from your beach, I like to go down to the garden and smell a handful of moist soil to get the real news of what's been happening while I was away. This soil is heavy and wet. The memory of its sea bottom history is held in every fog-clogged pore of the land. This soil has grown the food we eat and supported life for decades, so it's no surprise that we recognize and pay heed to each other. Chester Aaron, a writer and garlic grower gardening about 50 miles north of Green Gulch in Sonoma County, grows garlic because he cannot live without garlic. A Sonoma gardening friend told me that early in his career, his garlic career, Chester was given a variety of heritage garlic cloves by the Seed Savers Exchange. He grew them all. But to the delight of his gardening mentors, he kept selecting the same garlic variety time after time after time as the absolute best. The Seed Savers keyed out the garlic and found it was from the Republic of Georgia. It's from Tocliavari, interrupted Chester, suddenly full of life. Yeah, that's it. Tocliavari, they answered, surprised at Chester's animation. It turned out that although Chester was born and raised in the heart of New York City, all of his people, from his father to his grandfather and great-grandfather before him, hailed from the small, remote region of Tocliavari in the Republic of Georgia. Isn't that amazing? I hope it's true. May it be so. Red garlic from, you know, it is true. because there's some recognition whenever I remember this tale. Red Garlic from Tokliavari woke up Chester Aaron. For each of us, it will be a different taste or sound, distinct, particular, available to our own bloodlines. Much depends on staying in one place long enough for the voice of the watershed where you live to claim you in its own tongue. This happened to me one night years ago when I stood on the edge of Redwood Creek, swollen with winter rain, and watched it break free of the sandbar into the ocean at Muir Beach. Every year in late winter, the Pacific Ocean deposits huge drifts of black sea sand up against the wide shoreline cove of Muir Beach. As the land dries out after the winter storms, these sand deposits seal off the flow of Redwood Creek, which drops down deep underground into the beach sand, and the mouth of the creek is barred closed. This sandbar dams back the fresh waters of Redwood Creek until the rains of the next season flood the creek again and burst out the bar. Only that once was I lucky enough to be at the sucking mouth of the river as it rushed out into the sea. Sweet and salt water mingled in the dark, and the voice of the watershed where I live became my voice. That winter, the rains had come early. It must have been close to Thanksgiving because we were still bringing in our groaning squash harvest at Green Gulch. I'd been working alone in the rain all afternoon, cutting the soggy vines of the dense, flat-headed French Cinderella pumpkin, Potiron Rouge des Tempes, carrying the heavy pumpkins to the edge of the road where they would cure for a few days before going into the dark cellar beneath the Zendo where we stored winter vegetables. I remember the gleam of vermilion squash in the cold rain. They were almost red in the stormlight, the same color as the living embers at the base of the bonfire we build every New Year's Eve to welcome a fresh year. The pumpkin field that year was the last field before the beach. It was almost dark when I finished the harvest. I was wet all the way through my heavy yellow oilskin slicker. I wiped my muddy knife on the matted grass and I laid it across the glowing potiron squash. And I let the call of the thick sea pull me out to the beach. I stood on the edge of the ocean at the mouth of the swirling torrent of Redwood Creek, the river boiling black and surly in its chute. The wolf ocean gnawed at the narrow bone of sandbar that separates salt water from sweet. Cold needles of rain pocked the slate-dark sea. High above on the cliffs overhanging the ocean, the lamps of evening were being lit in the homes of Muir Beach. The reflection of these lights shook yellow and deep on the thick waves, like warm golden pumpkins themselves, bobbing on a black sea. I watched with my back to the rain, and when the river broke through the bar with a soft, heavy sigh, and thousands of gallons of water mingled at the mouth, I walked home alone in the dark. When you find your place where you are, said Dogen Zenji, great Japanese teacher from the 13th century, when you find your place where you are, practice occurs. And you know, locating ourselves, orienting, meaning getting your bearings, turning toward true north, finding your place is a delicate matter that's always changing. Any meditator worth his or her salt knows that we're dealing with an impossible paradox when we take our place, because that place is always changing, always new. Tonight, when the invitation came, for whom is this the first time? It is the first time for all of us here in this hall, the very first time. A dangerous, dangerous world. stepping in to the unknown core, finding our place, and then giving that place up, riding lightly and tasting the real taste of our life, whatever it may be, and being nourished by whatever is there. My teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh, years ago, I remember him holding up a bowl of fragrant rice from Thailand. I'm thinking of it tonight because of being in this beautiful place and feeling the connection with Southeast Asia. And I learned that in the old days, when a Vietnamese farmer would lift a rice lid and smell the steam coming off the rice, the smell of that steam would let the farmer know exactly what river valley that rice was from. It was carried in the life and the breath of the rice pot. And, you know, all of the mysteries and opportunities needed when we slow down and ground ourselves enough are present in what we find in our, what we are privileged to hold in our two hands. So when Thich Nhat Hanh visited us years and years ago at San Francisco Zen Center, we served him, knowing how he loved perfumed rice. We served him a beautiful bowl. I remember it was mounded with fragrant rice, and he was very solemn as the rice was served. And I remember him holding the bowl and picking it up and saying, you know, this fragrant rice, perfumed rice grown in the, and he named the valley in Thailand, will never be tasted by the children of that valley. It is exclusively for export to the wealthy of the world. With this taste of living rice, may we work for the well-being of all children on earth. Something like that. And I that was a very different and deeply nourishing and grounding way to eat for me, to taste that perfumed rice. And with each taste, to remember our deepest work. And, you know, and to gather the energy to do that work. So gardening at the Dragon's Gate, and I had to fight Bantam Books for that title. As they said, I think it's too abstract. I said, it's not abstract at all. Okay, well, I think it's too Eastern. The dragon doesn't belong to the East. Eventually, they let the title go through. And I think it was for very good reason, because there was a lot of worry that a mention of a dragon was too frightening or too mysterious or too esoteric. Even though I described the Dragon's Gate as a very important place in the life of any garden, it's the place where the known and the unknown worlds meet. Every garden occurs, every meditation center or corner occurs where the known and unknown worlds meet. And they only meet for a moment. So you see the gate, you go through, or it drops down and is barred. So you have an opportunity to go through the Dragon's Gate and garden right there where the worlds meet. And I asked the wonderful editor with whom I have had the immense privilege of working at Bantam, and I believe she'll be working with James, and also she's worked with Jack for many years. Wonderful person. I'll tell you a little story that'll make you laugh in a moment. But she said to me, you know, the real reason we let the title stand, she called me, she said, we've decided to let the title stand. And I said, I'm really, really grateful. She said, the reason we did it is because of the truth of global climate change right now, and feeling that we are at the fiery gate. Of course, the dragon is both fire and water, all the elementals mixed together and available to us. But that was significant to me, that the title would be would be accepted. And, you know, it's been a very intimate experience working with the folks at this publishing house, they who solicited the book, this book, because we've learned together. This wonderful editor said to me, whatever you do when you're writing, she used to make needle points for each of her authors in the early days. And she said if she had to make a needle point for me, she would embroider or she would stitch, stay in the garden. She'd say, stay close to the garden, because this book is not about your garden. Therefore, stay close to your garden. I thought, what are you, a Zen person? That's like, you know, the hocus pocus, the royal hocus pocus. But she was extremely helpful in encouraging me to stay close to my local experience so that the entire world of gardeners, known and unknown, born and to be born, could come in through the gate. And she also said, the book began, she also said that in the writing of the book, the voice should be immensely personal, and that it was difficult for meditation students of the Buddha Way in particular, to speak in the first person, to speak with clear courage, using your voice. Do not we us to death. She said, we do not like to be weed by the meditation community. So please do not we us. So I began the book, the first draft of the book began with a very personal statement of being a wild and unpredictable gardener, and ranting and raving and loving plants and all of that. And she said, when she looked through the manuscript, she said, the book can't begin this way. And I said, why not? You told me to be personal. She said, too personal? She said, yeah, it's a little too personal. I said, but it's your decision. I thought, I thought, okay, then I'm going to stand by it, because that's important, to stand the ground and then yield everything else. And then, you know, so I sent it back, and she was clearly displeased. And she said, I don't know. She said, I could see her actually puckering with displeasure. And so I said, what's the real problem? And she said, it's just too, and I said, egotistical? She said, exactly. I said, okay, then let it go. She said, I always get my Buddhist writers this way. I just thought it was such a wonderful experience. And you know, in the writing and in the bringing forth, calling forth and calling up the mind of the garden, really calling like a lover calls the loved one, the beloved, or like my friend and neighbor calls her dog, calls the shadow, and calling and responding to each other, the world comes up fresh and new, and we learn from each other in ways that we never would expect, beyond thinking. So let me drop down again with you into the garden. I just from sitting tonight and while you were milling around and speaking with each other, I had fresh thoughts about what might come up just from the sitting. So here's a tribute to a headless Buddha. There's a small altar in the Green Gulch glass greenhouse, and whenever I would go into this glass house to work, I always followed the same ritual, open the air vents to let the young plants growing under glass breathe fresh air, and then step up to the rustic altar, offer a stick of incense, begin the workday. On the glass house altar is an old, battered Buddha figure made of white plaster painted a bilious sea green, an 8-inch model of the great 40-foot-high bronze Kamakura Buddha crafted in 13th century Japan. In the Japanese tea garden of the Golden Gate Park in San Francisco, there's a 10-foot bronze copy of the Kamakura Buddha, who sits steadily beneath the flowering cherry trees of spring and the naked branches of winter. When our son Jesse was a wee baby, we laid him down in the huge folded hands of the Golden Gate Buddha one day. Jesse looked perplexed, but comfortable in his bronze cradle. And as I light incense in the glasshouse day after day, I can still see the baby in the Buddha's hands. Our plaster glasshouse Buddha is weathered and decomposing. Day by day, there is a little less of him. Still, for the last 30 years, this Buddha has been a loyal garden mascot. For many years, he sat outside, unprotected from the weather, keeping vigil in the dripping dawn fog of July, and enduring the occasional fiery sun that sears the coastal garden in late May and early October. Alone in the dark, the garden Buddha practices upright sitting through long winter nights of driving rain. A number of years ago, a fast-moving jet in our farm irrigation system went awry and blasted the green Buddha in his face, blowing off his calm, round head. I found the head the next morning face down in the front border of bloody Cranesbill geraniums. The Buddha's nose had been sheared off by the water's sword, and his face had a startled look. I put his head in his lap and remembered the ancient Gandharan Buddhas of Asia, defaced by bands of warriors more than a millennium ago. Although their stone noses were deliberately hacked off and their serene countenance deformed, these stone Buddhas maintain their sovereignty. For several years after losing his head, our green Buddha sat unperturbed in the garden with his head in his folded hands. There was something strangely comforting for me about gardening next to a headless Buddha. He kept reminding me to stop thinking so much, to believe in the garden that's older than thought, and in plants that are unthinkably determined and full of surprise, like the Chupe crab apples. I received a handful of this wild crabapple seed from East Central China at just about the same time that we were building our new glasshouse. I'd never sown tree seeds before, and I was anxious about their life cycle. These particular crabapple trees have been cultivated for centuries for the fine tisane or tea infusion that's made from their tender leaves. Sadly, the crabapple trees refuse to germinate. I hovered over them for months, willing them to sprout. Finally, I gave up in disgust. Sure that the seeds were no longer viable, still, I'd waited for so long that I was reluctant to dump the whole flat entirely, so I took it outside, away from the incubating warmth of our old ramshackle greenhouse, and abandoned my tree experiments to the vagaries of uncontrolled weather. Instantly, those crab apples went out of my mind. Months and months later, I found this seed flat, pushed over on its side by the winter winds. The Hupe crabapple trees were 4 inches tall, with three sets of glossy, true leaves. A white webwork of matted roots had split the bottom out of the old redwood seed flat, and the tree roots fanned wide, searching for deep soil, like a hungry newborn rooting at night for its mother's nipple. Once the Chinese crabapples were finally planted in the garden, they took hold without a thought and made themselves at home. Not long after, the new glasshouse was completed in the autumn of 1993, and the headless green Buddha finally moved inside. I sat him up on a fragrant round of oak, sawed from our beloved threshold oak. The new glass palace was dedicated with incense and flowers offered to the weather-pocked Buddha. Over the years since then, many Zen students have tried to repair him. Some clever, ecologically inclined meditators have attempted to stick his head back on with a handmade plaster of clay and soil mixed directly from the fields. Others have used melted candle wax from the altar. Some have even stooped to white glue repair. Because it's hard to offer incense day after day after day to a headless Buddha. It's unsettling. But no recapitation sticks. And the green Buddha is always headless again before very long. He stays put, his calm head resting in his lap, and tirelessly demonstrates the classic Zen admonition to think non-thinking. Open your mind so wide it includes your thoughts, your wish not to be thinking so much, and the garden all around you, deepening your life as a gardener. while planted just outside the headless Buddha's glass house, the Hupe crabapple trees now stand 9 feet tall, unthinkable in their beauty, and laden with tiny vermilion crabapples shot with gold. Think non-thinking. Think lovely non-thoughts. Anyway, and that's the essence, probably the greatest nourishment for a garden is dropping your thoughts about what the garden is, your plans. I give some advice to readers in this book that when you've got a really good idea or a good garden plan, go ahead, draw it up, and then lay it outside all night and let the snails crawl all over it and see what's left in the morning. Or give it to the worms and see how it comes back, digested by the intestines of the earth, which is what Charles Darwin called the earthworm. But what comes up for you? What comes up rising up from the root system of the real world as we investigate this unthinkable garden? Just let's cultivate the mind. It could be a question. It could be a comment. It could be a tribute. It could be anything at all. Here we go.
How could I pass up anything at all? I'm having a wonderful time this spring, just walking through Berkeley, looking at the flowers.
Yeah.
The colors. Yesterday I stood in one spot and I could identify 11 different colors within about 3 yards of where I was. And the most amazing thing is these tiny little beautiful woods flowers. And then other flowers that have like this yellow and red in the middle and the yellow on the outside. Some of them have like half the bush is one color and the other half the other. It's just, the multifaceted nature is just inspiring.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Think about a line from Issa, where he says, "In this world, we walk the roof of hell and we're gazing at the flowers." It's really, we know that's where we're walking. Flowers are just huge everywhere around us. Coming up. Thank you for that tribute. Yeah. Please.
They were saying that seeds sales are up 25% from last year. Like, right. People are just growing things now because of the economy. But also, I think, for all of the great experience. But right. It's just interesting that there's that inclination just in this country.
Right. Yeah. And, it is a political act to save seed, to go against the conglomeration of corporate entities that are trying to control the seed trade, gardeners and any people who love good food and love the freedom of the seed will not be held by that kind of restraint. So that to have a handful of seed and to grow it well and to share the harvest is our deepest inheritance and wealth as human beings. So that's an extremely encouraging fact. Yeah, and it's important to be doing that work now in these times, to remember where we come from. We are seed-created beings, so it's a great pleasure to have a handful of seed and plant it out. How many people are growing gardens from seed? Have that experience. It's a miracle. You take a little handful of dust and suddenly you have foxgloves that are all around you preaching the Dharma. You have to just put a little blanket over them to get them to be quiet. You know, and all the, you know, the just the huge wealth. Thank you for that tribute. So important. Anything else? There's a
You write beautifully.
Thank you very much.
What a gift. I hope this isn't too random, but as someone like yourself who works so closely with mm-hmm. the cycles of life, mm-hmm. could you just talk a little bit about death and dying?
Yeah. You know, every garden worth its weight in gold is completely dependent on death, life into death into life. The real fertility of the garden comes from what is dead, what's discarded, what's neglected, what's forgotten. Stacked up death. And I remember years ago at Green Gulf saying, you know, we don't proselytize about Zen, but try us on compost. Try us on death. And, you know, the garden has to be willing to be undone. In this book, I thought, you know, with great appreciation for your comments about the flowers, I thought, I want hag roses to be as available to the reader as the glory of Alan Chadwick's favorite rose. It was an exquisite drawing of a rose in here. But I begged my friend Davis to also bring forth the dead and diseased roses too. So they would be welcome in the pages. So the disease would be included. So we would remember the ancient Buddhist teaching that medicine and disease subdue each other. They're made of each other. That death and life into death into life is the formula for making compost. That all fertility depends on nature's round and on the stacking up of death. We're standing on the backs of the ancestral beings that have created the stripes of time, you know. So a garden without death, decay, and a little disorder is a fearsome place. You know, just no Stepford Gardens for us. You know, we're looking at a garden that will stand forth. I remember when the drawings that are in this book, which really do illustrate death and decay, we made a pledge that we would make the insects bigger than life. They'd be flying through pages, dominating like they do in the world. The worms would be large, you know. The black spot would be dark, you know. The aphids would really show what they're up to in the book. And one of my young friends that I work with at King Middle School, where I work one day a week here in your neighborhood, was looking at the drawings when they first came in, and she said, "Wait a minute. You mean this book is about the real garden? You know, about the garden that's both dead and alive?" So death runs throughout. If you will, it's kind of like the drone that runs underneath all the bagpipe music. The lilting, wonderful melody depends on that old drone underneath. The kind of... And that's the welcome voice of decay, you know, of what my teacher Soen Roshi used to call the great majority, those who crossed over. He said, "Go, what? Why be afraid? Join the great majority. You can join the great majority." So the great majority is, you know, speaking. I hope speaking loudly and clearly in the book. I'm so glad you asked that question, because without it, we're not grounded. We want a beautiful garden that's, you know, we want a garden that's perpetually in flower, that is seasonally glorious, that never goes out of color, bloom, water, health. It's so boring. There's a tribute in the book, I don't think I have time to read it, of Louise Halberg's garden in Sonoma County. She has a butterfly garden. I made the mistake, people had encouraged me for years to go visit her garden. See this garden. You're going to love it. I went in the fall when the garden was being completely dismantled by starving, hungry caterpillars of butterflies. It was the most fearsome place I'd ever visited. And let me just do a little bit. It's a better way to answer. And I don't usually... You got to have people that have a certain stomach for this stuff. It's called the dung and drool garden. To really see a garden and the life inside a garden takes your whole life. This seeing can be dangerous and unsettling, as I discovered a few years ago when I visited the butterfly preserve of an old and renowned Lepidopterus. I hated that garden. Not that you don't learn from what you dislike, you do. Electric shock teaches. Falling in wet cow manure reminds you to walk a higher path next time. I'm sure Louise's garden had particular lessons, especially for me, even though it pressed against me like a gaunt tomcat with a broken rib. From the moment I walked through her gate, Louise's legendary butterfly garden set me on edge and made my teeth hurt. Expecting to taste a ripe, full-blown burgundy cherry of a garden, I was served a renegade, unripe green plum. And even now, many years later, I'm still unable to clear the raw metallic taste of that garden from the roof of my mouth. And what upset me about it was the prevalence and the featured presentation of death. I mean, in the very heart of Louise's garden was an old catalpa tree, completely dead, serving as a skeleton trapeze for a thick grapevine that wound around its bleached bones high overhead, supported by the dead tree. Fat bunches of ripe green grapes swung in the open sunlight 25 feet above the floor of the garden. "For the birds and the wasps," remarked Louise gaily, tracking my spellbound gaze. "I let them have all my grapes so they won't bother the butterfly larvae down here in the garden." There were other dead trees throughout that garden. They stood like phantom sentinels, protecting a garden vibrantly alive, though pocked with death. Shaped from the bony frame of a line of ghost trees on the periphery of the garden were long, thick ropes of healthy Aristolochia californica Dutchman pipevine, a native medicinal plant. Although pipevine is medicinal, it's also poisonous. So she had her entire garden was draped with these poisonous plants on dead trees, with butterflies eating, pooping in the garden. I just stood there thinking, where am I? And where is the gate? Out of here. And she was just so delighted by that, you know, she just loved it, and it really upset me. And I recognize how I talk a good line, but when it comes to watching insects destroy plants and create more death, I was not so available. But that is still a garden that I learned from immensely. Yeah. Let's see, so there must be other comments on that, on death. Let's hear from someone who hasn't spoken, and we'll come back. Yeah.
This isn't exactly on that, but some people feel very strongly about native plants versus
right.
invasive plants.
Right.
And I just wondered your thoughts on that.
Right. Oh, I love that question. I remember when Alan Chadwick was very sick at the end of his life, we asked him, he said, "Will you please offer me some questions to keep me alive? Or are you going to be so cruel that you won't do that?" We said, "All right, we'll ask you some questions." And one of the first questions he got was that question. And he actually couldn't answer. His love of plants was so intense, especially in the end of his life. He didn't discriminate between the different categories of plants. So that had a very strong effect on me. And, you know, I think for each gardener that's the Dragon's Gate. You know, how are you going to cross in or out if you only, you know, and what is native and what's non-native? I mean, I've been thinking about this question, and I look at myself, you know, making all these selections, you know, from Southern European stock, marching around the garden as if I have the right and, you know, ordination to do the kinds of things I'm doing. So I began to see myself not only as an invasive exotic, but also as a pest. And that was a bit, you know, and in, you know, in meditation practice, we have that rare opportunity now and then to exchange places with self and other and bring you know, bring the dead trees in close. Bring the question in, what is native, what is not native. Bring it in close and really look at it. And when you're designing a garden, all of those issues are very important. And then you ask yourself, what are the primary matters here? What's the primary concern that I'm dealing with? So, you know, this kind of dilemma causes you to really practice, to really examine your mind and to see your mind open up and perhaps change or grow wider or more tolerant or more experimental or fiercer. You know, so I think it's a very important question. And in our work at Green Gulch, we try to really just draw from the landscape and the palette of native plants outside of the garden gate and within the garden to manage and maintain a landscape that does include different plant communities growing together, and to do that mindfully. One thing that I'll say that was a very interesting experience for me, we have a Japanese tea garden at Green Gulch, you know, a tea garden that is beautiful. It's called Sowing the Moon Tea Garden. It's right outside the office. And my dream, when that garden was set up, was to have it be fully planted with California native plants. And the idea, because a tea garden offers you respite from the world, not a very rich flowering experience, but a very simple, clean, clear palette. And I thought, let's do it with California natives rather than drawing on the plantscape of Japan. Because if you're only drawing on the plantscape for Japan, I reasoned to myself, then you might have the mistaken feeling that sense of calm, grounded, quiet, and depth can only be achieved when you're in Japan. You can't have it in Hunter's Point, you know, where the soil is poisoned and you can sit down for a minute on a bench overlooking the bay and come back to yourself, because you have to go to Japan. You have to go outside of yourself. So that was a huge moment for me. And the garden is beautifully landscaped with thoroughly Japanese plants. And, you know, I had the pleasure of living next door for years with a very voluptuous Cecile Bruner Rose, and she would throw her pink petals all over the tea garden, and I thought, yeah, that's good. It's good for the tea garden, you know, to mess up the order a little bit, to mess up the mind. So this kind of question you're bringing up causes us to really think and to take a position, but hopefully not be too rigid, to use it as an opportunity to really think deeply about what we're doing. Hope that's not too big a dodge. Yes.
Death and invasives and pruning.
Invaded by death.
The idea of pruning and weeding.
Yeah.
And insects that are eating your lettuce and do no harm.
Mm-hmm.
And a disciplined life versus a
free-form
life.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. But what do you think? What do you do about that quandary?
Well, in my work life, I'm forced to be pretty disciplined and structured. And in the rest of my life, I'm pretty out of control.
Yeah. I remember years ago, Thich Nhat Hanh saying the most important and the only way, the only true precept is the precept of mindfulness, bringing the heart and mind together in the present moment and really looking at what you're doing and how you're thinking about it. And the garden causes you to do that. You know, you're all your great intentions can go very fast down the tubes when that single-minded pocket gopher begins gnawing at the roots of your beloved persimmon tree and it begins to quiver and shake. I saw a persimmon in full fruit go down at Tassajara to the teeth of a gopher, and all of my peaceful, nonviolent communication, I should probably come on Saturday, also went down, you know, as I pursued that gopher through the garden, you know, and that's a, you know, it's a huge question. You have the opportunity to begin again at every point, and to really know the mind, shape the mind, free the mind as deeply as you can. And the garden gives you that opportunity because you deeply care about it. For those of us that do, you deeply care and are engaged in it. So hopefully to have the notion that there could be some
exemption from birth and death is a folly. It's just not possible. Drinking this glass of water, there are billions of microorganisms in this water that go into my body. So maybe that's like Thich Nhat Hanh holding up the bowl of rice, recognizing birth and death in this bowl of rice, in this glass of water, in the picking up this tool to dig into the garden. You know, no exemption and no extinction of it. So what a privilege, you know, to do our best, to do our best. And it's getting a little late. So I think a couple of minutes. Take one more question, and then I want to actually give people who haven't had a chance to speak. Yeah. Go ahead.
I'll make it real fast. I'm more embarrassed to take up twice, but I want to share it with you. It's so fantastic. I'm much privileged to be at MBL at one of these lecture series where one of the top biophysicists in the world was describing the latest thing and how genes do different things. And I like to go up after and talk to him. And what he said was incredible. He said that death is not a bug, it's a feature. That we invented death. We as biologically evolving creatures die on purpose. It changes everything.
Do you want to say something?
Yeah. Just playing off the life and death topic again. I've read some of Alan Watts where he talks about sort of the idea of life and death that's so we take it Westerners we take it as so serious as, you know, life is, oh, you have to get this done and you have to make this much money and here's your next goal. And then death is always in the future, this really dark, you know, scary kind of place that we don't want to go. And really changing, swapping that around to seeing it more as a play,
right,
as more of you know, well, it doesn't really matter all that much. And I was wondering if you might have something to add or just your thoughts on that from the garden perspective of life and death cycle as play.
Well, they belong to each other, don't they, like forward and backward steps. It's very much the insight of the person that spoke right before you, you know, in his enthusiasm. You know, enthusiasm, you know, a deep meditation practice welcomes death and knows that we're made. There's life and death in every breath as we take in the world and the suffering of the world and give back a great, the relief. Relief to have death be so close. At our left shoulder, always very close to us, reminding us of how precious this life is. And then every moment is fresh and dangerous and possible. The coming together and the recombining of life in every moment. So it's a huge privilege to be with you tonight, and it's been really wonderful to be here. And I'd like to dedicate the merit of our sitting and practice and conversation to the full well-being of the many beings, human and more than human beings in this world. May every being in the 10 directions have enough to eat. And may we all work for the awakening of all that is. Well, thank you very, very much. And I did bring a box of books if anyone is interested in a copy of it. What's great about the Garden Book is the copyright and the ownership of the book is held by the San Francisco Zen Center. I wrote the book as part of my life and practice at Zen Center. So purchasing the book supports the work of mindful awareness and you know, the work of meditation in the wider community. And so if you're interested, there will be some book. I hope that's okay to do. I think everyone said bring a box, so I have a box hidden. Oh, but more important than that, how could I nearly forget this? on the steps of the Berkeley Buddhist Temple outside, Berkeley Buddhist Monastery, are two flats of tomatoes propagated by rambunctious, disobedient middle school students. The topmost flat, 16 plants, and there's two tomatoes per pot, is the beautiful Brandywine tomato. Delicious. So if you've got a hot garden or a hot friend or a hot date, take that Brandywine tomato to that person. And then one step down is Marmande, a great delicious tomato from the central region of France. Delicious heritage in honor of the wild deeds that make our world. So grown from seed by naughty children, full of life force. These are a few left over from our plant sale, and they are available for your pleasure tonight. So when you go out, look to your left and pick up a tomato and watch the world come apart. Watch all of your opinions and aloof situation fade as passionate love for tomatoes dominates your landscape. So thank you very much. And what a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.